You're listening to Finding Your Genius Zone with Dirk Novell. With the help of successful individuals across industries, Dirk breaks down the unknown parts of every vocation while highlighting the importance of finding a career where you can leverage your natural skills, passions, and interests. Now here's your host, Dirk Novell.
Hey everybody, this is Dirk Novell. Welcome to my podcast. On with me is a friend of mine, Judge Richard Jones. Richard, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me today.
I appreciate it. I always do a little intro, and I think, six, seven, 8 years, maybe longer, I've known you. Unfortunately, I only get to see you once a year at a holiday party, but you know, I've always really enjoyed talking to you. You're a very nice man, very humble. And to be honest, I didn't really know what you did. I think probably till the fourth year, and it's very impressive. So again, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for the opportunity to share with you and share with your viewing audience.
All right. So, I'm going to have about 100 of these and people are coming in hot. So I'm going to have you in the legal judge. I'm not sure what the title will be. We can talk about it, but let's kind of just cut right into that. I would love if you could just give kind of a quick summary of, you know, I know that you, going back to school, you were getting a business degree or a law degree and you decided the law, you're a lawyer. I know that you didn't necessarily think you were going to be a judge and that kind of happened, but maybe you could walk us through the history a little bit about how you got to be where you're at today.
Sure. I began my career actually as a King County prosecutor because I always wanted to be a trial lawyer. I thought if you're going to go to law school, the whole purpose of going to law school was to have the opportunity to be in the courtroom. So that's where I wanted to begin my career. I was a King County prosecutor for several years, and then I had the opportunity to go in-house as a lawyer representing the Port of Seattle. Port's a huge operation. It's like having one client that does a little bit of everything, real estate, aviation, marine. And after I did that for several years, I had an opportunity to work at one of the biggest firms in the city. It's called Bogle & Gates. They're no longer in existence. Big litigation firm, big overarching firm, and covered many areas and was one of the oldest firms in the city. After doing that for several years, my true love was to go back to litigation because I wasn't trying as many cases in private practice. So I became a federal prosecutor. I did that for several years. And after doing that for many years, I decided I want to stay in a courtroom. I want to have a continued career in law, but I don't necessarily want to be the person trying the case. So I went and got all the evaluations by the different reviewing entities, different bar associations, and I did well. And then a judge passed away. And shortly after he passed away, a friend of mine called and said, "You put your name in to become a judge." And I said, "No." I said, "Today is the man's funeral." And my friend said, her words, not mine, "Look, fool, if you don't apply, 100 other people are going to apply for that job." I sent my resume in on Tuesday. I got a call back from the governor's office Wednesday. Thursday, I was interviewed by the governor's office. Friday, I was appointed at 11:45. Sunday night, I quit my job as a federal prosecutor. The following Monday, I raised my hand and took the oath of office. I don't encourage anybody to go through that process that fast. That's how I became a King County Superior Court judge.
I remember because I was listening to your oral history, which you talked about. And, for more information on you, I think it's really good 60 minutes to watch. And I remember the story about, did she call you a fool or a dummy? I thought she called you a dummy.
No, I'll never forget the words.
I love it. So there's a lot of things when I was listening to your oral history that I wanted, and I don't want to forget them. So one of the things you just mentioned, people that are watching are probably interested in the legal world. And I don't know, I guess the question is when you get into law school and do people want to I want to be a lawyer, then a judge, or does the judge thing kind of happen over the course of time? And I mean, you weren't pursuing being a judge early on and you were so active. I think you were kind of concerned about sitting in one spot. Like, is it common for lawyers to figure that out 10, 15 years into their career?
Every once in a while, I'll run into a law student who will tell me, "I want to become a judge." That's a rarity. To be honest with you, when I was practicing law, I was having so much fun being a trial lawyer that the idea of becoming a judge, and as you indicated, being confined and locked down, that seemed too restraining. And I didn't think it would be that exciting. But I have to tell you, the most rewarding job I've ever had in my entire life was having the opportunity in public service as a judge. The challenges, the rewards of making a difference in people's lives, not every once in a while, but every single day, whether it's sentencing, civil litigation, where someone's suing somebody, someone may not be happy when they walk out of the courtroom, but my motto was always make sure that people feel that they were heard and they had a just chance in front of a judge that was listening to them and heard their arguments.
You mentioned something, I think, your father said a lot, a quote or something, and I don't want to butcher it by saying it, but it was kind of a something about if you're going to do something, do it well, do it all the way you can. Can you repeat that a little bit?
Sure. My dad was a carpenter, and the one thing he pushed constantly was to do excellent work, no matter what the work was, what the assignment was. And what he drilled into all of our heads was, once a task is once begun, be the labor, great or small, give the job your very best or none at all. So I've always tried to approach my jobs, my responsibilities, as giving everything I have to give with all the experience, education, and knowledge that I have.
So the word, I forgot what it was, but you go through a process, and I think it's pretty involved about, it's like an interview process when you want to become a judge. What was that called?
It's essentially in the King County process, you really just send your name in for an evaluation committee and you get rated. And there's a judicial screening committee that is supposed to screen all the candidates or applicants. Some people, because of their backgrounds, whatever it is, don't trust that process. So they just run on an open ticket. Others traditionally will go through and get rated so that the community feels that this judicial screening committee, which is usually between 15 to 20 plus lawyers that have practiced, have an opportunity to evaluate you, do background checks. So then when we give your evaluation to the community feels comfortable in your rating. All the ratings I'd received were always exceptionally well qualified. That's the rating that you'd like to have that's published in the newspaper.
Okay. So when I heard you talk about that before, I was curious, like, what is the criteria, the skill sets? Like, obviously, intelligence, your knowledge. But like, you know, does that mean that you can't have strong opinions? Like, what are the things that like translate to a high evaluation? Because like, I think of myself and like, I have strong opinions. And does that mean that I would grade low on something like that? Like, what is it about you that kind of gave you such high grades?
It's not a question of being strong, opinionated or having strong opinions. It's a question of, given a set of circumstances presented to you, can you set those feelings or strong opinions aside? Because if you have strong feelings about a particular issue, you shouldn't handle that case. I'll give you a classic example. Let's say an individual does not believe in the death penalty. When we had the death penalty in the state of Washington, if you as a trial judge believe that you couldn't be fair and impartial in making a decision in a death penalty case, you should call the presiding judge and ask for this case to be reassigned. I had a case that was the Green River murder, Gary Ridgway. That case is the man who had been accused at the time of killing 48 different women. Now, I'm not saying for or against the death penalty, but I had to be able to set aside my own personal opinions about the death penalty as that case progressed towards a plea or towards trial. Now, put it this way, by the time that case was over, I had made issued opinions on 60 plus different motions filed by the parties in terms of the type of evidence to come in, the type of issues, the DNA challenges. You have to make all those decisions again. Try and be bias free. There's oftentimes cases where you have a child molestation or child abduction. And if you have children, that's a tough task. I recall having a case where a young child was brutally murdered. I have children. Do I want to have my own personal feelings about the love that I have for my children be so impactful that I can be fair and impartial and make sure this defendant, despite what they're accused of or charged with, they're entitled to a fair trial. And that's what your responsibility is.
So I was thinking about that because you were talking about the Gary and the Green River. I think it was like 18 months, but I remember you talking about how they walked you up to the seventh floor and then they had the policemen lined up. That's where they brought Gary. And I think ultimately you're saying three steps to the, just the pressure that you were taking on as the judge. Is it a conviction that, listen, this is the law, this is what I'm supposed to, like when you have personal feelings about something like that, like what is the skill set for you to be able to kind of like go right to, I don't even know how to say it, but like make, like be consistent with how you're supposed to be as a judge, because you're a human person and you're going to have personal feelings. But I would think that there's a process that you go by to help you kind of put your personal feelings aside and stay consistent. Like, is there an exercise you follow or is it just a mindset?
Well, I really believe that it's a mindset and it's a development with experience. And when I used to teach at the Judicial College, and that was one of the hardest things to teach new judges, was to get that mindset that you don't overreact. Oftentimes you'll read about something in the newspaper the day before, and then a few days later, that case is in front of you. You can't be so biased and have such strong feelings about that particular case or that subject matter that you can't set those aside. You really have to dig deep, because oftentimes you have, for example, a defendant who's disruptive. I had a defendant in a double homicide case that was angry at one of my pretrial rulings, and he grabbed one of these heavy oak tables, threw it over, and tried to run and get to me in the courtroom. Now, this guy was about 6'3", 6'4", 200 plus pounds. He could have been a linebacker in a Super Bowl easily. It was so big. I still had to make sure this man had a fair trial, an opportunity to present his case, present his arguments, and not be influenced by the fact that he tried to attack me. If I felt so strong about what he did in court, then I'd have to say I've got to recuse myself and step aside. So it's always keeping that balance of your demeanor, your ability to process difficult and challenging issues, to do the research, to look at what the lawyers have provided for your consideration, and to dig deep in what they provided and get past spin and look at facts, law, and evidence and make your decision based upon those criteria.
So let me think how to ask this question. Like, I think of the Navy SEALs, like people want to be a Navy SEAL, but they don't really know if they can until they're going through the process. Right. Like, I would think in your career, your line of work, like you don't know until you kind of really are faced with, I mean, you think you know, and maybe that's part of being a lawyer and having credibility. But once you get to a case like the Green River killings, I would think that you kind of, I mean, do you ever think, I don't know how I'll handle this. I hope I handle it this way. Or did you know that you'd be okay?
You never know. My philosophy has always been in teaching judges or sharing this information with lawyers or law students is you can't test the strength of a ship in calm waters. That ship may look absolutely magnificent at the shore, but until you get the ship in a storm with the seas cascading over, with the turbulence of the waters, the wind, the pressure, until you're in that environment, you don't know how you're going to perform. You don't know when you take those three steps to come into the courtroom and walk on that bench, what it's going to feel like when you have 300 people in the courtroom who are angry, upset, hostile. We have security to protect you and protect other members of the public and to protect the defendant. You just don't know how you're going to react or respond until that moment. It's all a question of using all the skill sets that you've learned and developed over time to be able to stand up and make those decisions and feel comfortable. Because if you're weak at the knees in terms of how you come out and how you make your rulings, or you're uncertain, there's no confidence conveyed to the community or to the defendant or to the parties that this person can handle something this magnitude. And again, you don't know. You can go to Judicial College forever, but until you get in that situation when you're on that bench by yourself, that you have to figure out, do I have the capabilities, a skill set to perform?
So when you look back on your life, and you think about, like, were there moments or episodes where, I mean, that gave you the confidence? Like, there are things that were like that changed the course of your life that maybe led you in this direction where you knew you could have. Like, I hear you that you said you don't know until you don't know. But you also, when I look at your history, I mean, you had a lot of obstacles and speed bumps growing up. You know, I mean, remember the story of your first job, and you walked in and he had mentioned that, you know, the partners were concerned about white clients and a black attorney. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but like you had a lot of issues growing up that I would assume kind of built this strength that you use today.
Well, let me reframe what actually happened.
Please.
I was a law student. And I was clerking at the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is a fabulous job, fabulous opportunity to learn how to be a good trial lawyer. And I hadn't applied to this particular firm, certainly wasn't big Bogle and Gates, but it's one of the biggest firms in the city. They called and asked me to apply, and I did. And I went through the whole hiring process. We do the callback interview, the individual interviews, group interviews. And so the day that we were having a lunch, the U.S. attorney by the name of Stan Pitkin came into the clerk's office. And I remember walking up behind me, grabbed my shoulders and said, "Jones, go get him." He said, "You're going to get this." He said, "We're so proud of you. You've gotten glowing recommendations from everybody in the firm." So when I left, I was soaring. I was so happy getting that kind of support from my boss at the U.S. attorney's office. So I went to the restaurant called Rosalini's 410 downtown, one of the best restaurants. So this whole thing was set up beautifully that I was going to get a job offer, a big firm, big bucks. And I walked in, he was sitting there with his elbows on the table and a glass of water. No one else was at the table. And I walked in and I said, "Sir, I can recognize good circumstances and a positive outcome and not so positive. Instead of laboring through an uncomfortable lunch, how about if we go straight to the reason I'm here?" And he began by saying, "Richard, I've made a recommendation, a strong recommendation for you to be hired, but the firm, I can't offer you a position right now because I talked to the senior partners and I'm not quite sure how our clients would react to having a black lawyer represent them." And then he followed it with, "But don't take it personal." So I went and talked. I was just devastated. I walked out of there. I didn't know what to do. I was ashamed to go back to my office and tell my boss I didn't get the job, or tell my colleagues I didn't get the job because I was black, or that somebody had discriminated against me. So what was I supposed to do? I actually went and talked to two other lawyers, one Lem Howell, who's a civil rights litigator, and I also talked to who later became Washington State Supreme Court Justice Charles E. Smith. Both gave me the same advice. "Richard, I'll represent you, but if I do take your case, I want you to know it'll be long, hard, hard fought. They've got tons of resources to spend against you, and you don't have that kind of money. And at the end, even if you win, you'll be blackballed from the practice of law because other firms will always look at you and say, that's the guy that sued because he was black to get a job." And I had to take that blow, that hard punch, that as angry as I was and upset as I was, that helped build armor around me to know whatever the obstacles are, you have to overcome and defeat them. After that, I put my picture on my resume. And I've never seen since then anybody else with a picture and a resume. And the reason I did that, because as I sent my resume around to other firms, I wanted somebody to know it's a black man that's applying for your firm. If you've got issues, put it in a garbage can. So if you're serious considering my qualifications, then let's have a talk. Matter of fact, within 2 weeks, I sent my application over to Chris Bailey, who was a King County prosecutor at the time, and I was offered a job almost right away. So I knew I was qualified. It was just depending upon who the decision makers were.
And I think this is interesting for the audience because I think your life, I mean, you make decisions that can change. It's pivotal. And I think there's a lot of people that experience whatever, speed bumps, friction, their own issues, and maybe they don't move on. Maybe they get so angry and they give up. I guess, is there a piece of advice? I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about the quote your father installed in you, but if somebody's kind of feeling anger or bitterness and they feel like, for whatever reason, it's not a fair deal, is there anything you might say to somebody you know, for example, if somebody wants to go to law school and he or she has nobody in their family that's ever done it and they don't feel like they can do it, any advice you'd give to somebody in that situation?
Sure. I'd say, first of all, don't harbor anger, hatred, or malice, or feeling that you want revenge to get back. That's a wasted emotion. Because if you spend all your time with a motif of, I'm going to get you guys back, I'm going to pay you back at some point in time in my life, I'll get even with you. If you're going to spend that, that's wasted mentality. It's wasted energy. I've always believed, I read this in a book years ago. It said, the best revenge in life is living a good life. And that's all depending upon what you do. Now, you're going to face challenges and obstacles as you practice law. But the reality is, if you want to have a healthy life and healthy practice, you gear on the things that you can control, the things that you can create. And after that bad experience, I dedicated a good percentage of my work in the community is to make sure that people didn't have to go through that again, to create opportunities, to create programs. I've lectured countless times. I have scores of mentees to try and help them get through those tough times in life. It may not be as blatant as it was back then in the 70s, but you may still run into speed bumps, roadblocks, or hurricanes, but you can't let those obstacles prevent you from doing anything. I've got a little metal block on my desk that has been there for years, and it says, what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? Think about that. What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? So I start my day off every morning turning on my computer, and the first thing I look at is, what are you going to do today? What are you going to attempt to do, knowing that you're not going to fail? Not that I have an ego that's so big to say, Richard's so arrogant that he knows he's not going to have any mistakes. That's not where I'm going. I'm talking about to have the courage, based upon experience and knowledge, to be able to take on the toughest assignments and be able to know, I'm going to do this as though I'm not going to fail at this. But I know I have to put a lot of effort, time, and energy to make that a reality as opposed to just speculation and conjecture.
Is there anything you still want to do, like big time, or do you feel like you've kind of done it? Like, I know you're continuing down. I mean, you're not done in your career. You're still taking on cases, but is there something out there that you think about or dream about, or do you feel like you've arrived?
I'd say that 60-pound salmon is sitting out there in the river someplace still waiting for me. And so I love to fish. I love outdoors. I love gardening. I love to spend time in a healthy environment. And so it's not so much living a long time, it's having a healthy lifespan. And so it's a question of mentally and physically, what are you doing to take care of yourself so that however you have by way of length of time on this planet, it's healthy and you really enjoy what you're doing. If I didn't like the work that I was doing, I could retire. I could retire this afternoon. But I really enjoy making a difference in people's lives, helping other people, and help them shine a light on other people to help them grow and help them become better people and become better lawyers and better people. I got a note today from a woman that I had sentenced. She was in a hard, hardcore set of circumstances. And I had to send her to prison. But in terms of what I shared with her, and she came back when she was released on probation, and we continued to work with this woman. And she came and visited Christmas time with her young daughter. Now, she's living in a tiny house right now. She still has the struggle of drugs. But in terms of the encouragement and the work and the time and effort that we put into making her have some degree of success. Now, is she drug-free? No. Will she ever do drugs again? Probably not. But the fact is, right now, she believes that she can succeed. So it's all about planting seeds and trying to help them grow and do whatever you can do to help someone have success in their lives. I've been blessed with so many good opportunities in my life and a career that I love. If I can spread that wealth around, that's my goal. And then when I check out of here, mission accomplished.
So along those lines, I'm just kind of like, you may have answered it, but I want to make sure I'm on the same page as far as your why. Like, you know, you told the story of the woman you helped in near Madison Park who was potentially going to lose her tavern. And I think there's some clarity that kicked in for you. Like you took it on pro bono, I believe, but then you just, you had this moment of, this is what I'm here for. I guess my question is, what is your why?
Well, let me put in context the example that you gave, because I think the listeners won't know. Yep. There's a woman that owned a tavern that was over on about 21st or so in Madison. And the only divide between the wealth and richness of Madison Park and downtown Seattle was about a 1 or 2 block area. And just about all the established businesses, a tavern, a couple restaurants, were all African-American owned. And there's a woman there that was in her 80s, soaking wet. She probably weighed about 85 pounds. And she knew who I was. And so she came to me, and I was in private practice, big law, and thinking I was all that and as a lawyer. And she said, could I come and talk to you about something? So I thought it was something to do with the church. So when she comes, we sit down and she says, they're trying to take my tavern. I said, what do you mean? Her husband passed away years ago. She had never worked anyplace else other than the tavern. So this is her only source of income. And the liquor board had come in and issued about 7 or 8 different violations to essentially close her down if they were successful in their efforts. And so we talked and I said, Dorothy, I really don't have time. And then I thought about it and I said, all the things that people have done for me to help me get to where I am today, and you're going to turn on this woman who's in her 80s, didn't have any resources, then why did you go through all this in the first place? If you can't help and if you refuse to help this woman, you don't deserve to be here. And so we talked, and in preparation for the hearing or trial, I asked her, I said, would you testify? And she said, I have a heart attack. I got high blood pressure and a bad heart. I said, do you have any witnesses? She said, you come to the tavern. I went and interviewed witnesses, and everybody either had a warrant or they were afraid to come in contact with law enforcement. So I didn't have any witnesses. She wouldn't testify. I didn't have any evidence. So the only thing I had was just a skill set of cross-examining. So for the duration of the hearing and for every witness that came up, I examined, cross-examined, and examined, and examined, and I gave everything I had. And I have to be honest with you, every time I tell the story, I get a little emotional because I knew at that point in time, I had her life in my hands. If I lose, she loses everything. And that's the reason I put that much energy and effort. So the judge left and he came back for the resolution of the matter. He came out, started going through each count saying, we find for the defendant. We find for the defendant. And it was not guilty in all counts. So she had these great big glasses, these big dangling earrings, and she didn't understand what was going on. And she said, what happened? And I said, you won, Dorothy. And she just collapsed in my arms and just started crying. And she kept on crying. And we stayed there to try and calm her down. And it was the last hearing of the day. And they basically said, okay, you have to leave. And I said, Dorothy, let's go home. Let me take you home now. And that to me was bigger than every other case that I've had. When people ask me, what's the big biggest case you had, because of what was on the line, that was the biggest case that I have. It was most meaningful for me. And it always made me revisit when a question of, do you have time? Are you prepared to help somebody else? Yeah, you got to stretch, but you have to stretch for the right reason and not just say, because it's easier for me to say no.
Yeah, that's a powerful story. Let me switch gears a little bit. You know, you and I were talking last time I saw you about a case. I guess the question I have is why do you get, like, I don't understand the process of when something comes up, a case, do they say, hey, Richard, I think you'd be great on this? Or what does that process look like as far as how a judge takes on a case? Or is it a competition? I'm just curious, like you mentioned one that you're working on. Why you?
Well, I'll give you an example. First of all, in the King County system, it's a random selection in terms of who's assigned a particular case. In the Gary Ridgway case, because the case was so big, I used to keep a diary. And on March 25, 2002, my diary entry said, Presiding Judge Edie just asked me to handle Green River murder trial. Asked if I had plans to retire within the next 2 to 3 years or pursue a higher court. The case was mine. And he closed was, this case is of a magnitude where the entire world will focus on King County. You will represent us. I know you'll do well. are you prepared to take on the assignment? So he gave me overnight to think about it. And that's a different kind of case. It was so big that it didn't go in normal rotation. In federal court, we have what's called a wheel. What the wheel means is all cases that are assigned or filed are weighted cases. Some are really complex cases that might get a higher weight. Something may be a whole lot easier and gets a lower weight. So you won't get two super complex cases back to back, but it's completely random so that there's no prejudging or predetermination of how, why a particular judge gets a particular case.
Are you, I don't know if you're even able, you talked about a big case that you were about to take on. Are you able to speak to that or is that confidential?
I've had so many big cases. I can't say, I don't recall. And if it is a pending case, I can't ever talk about a pending case. I can talk about what you might see in the newspaper, right, but I couldn't talk about any specifics beyond that.
Now, I won't say anything. I don't understand the world you're in, so I want to make sure. I do want to kind of go back to how you handle, like, with the case you talked about with Gary. Like, just how do you go home and chill out? Like, how do you wind down? Like, I don't know. I hear the story and all the stuff that was going on and the attention, like that to me is a skill set. Like, how do you do that?
It's almost like you have to compartmentalize. We have your work in one part of your brain, yeah, and you have your personal life. And put it this way, I do sentencings every Friday, and I've done sentencings every Friday for the last 25 plus years. And when I finish making a decision or a sentence, it's because I put all the effort and energy into making that decision, and it's easier for me to move on. If I hadn't done my homework or hadn't done due diligence for that particular case, I'd think about it a lot. But I can tell you that there are some cases that just haunt you. I'll give you an example. There was one young girl, she was about 10 years old, and her stepfather had molested her for a significant period of time. And I remember her coming into court, and she could barely look over the bench when she came up to speak. And she said, "I don't want to be in trouble. I didn't do this to hurt my daddy. I just did it because I didn't want him to do to my sister what he did to me." And so it was her innocence and her words that had a dramatic impact on what I did by way of a sentence, because here's a completely innocent young child. But then again, at the same time, you have to pull back the reins of your emotion to say, that you want to just max out on somebody like that. Now, whether it happened or not, you still have to process what's the right thing to do and the fairest thing to do in light of these circumstances. Now, when I go home at night, it's those cases like that that sometimes stick with you for a long time in terms of not that you second guess your decision, but just the impact on that little girl. The Ridgeway case, having 300 people in the courtroom, and for 3 hours, having people pour out their emotions from forgiveness to hate to anger to frustration, and to walk away from there and say, I have to move on. And it's difficult to move on from a case like that because I pray to God we never have anybody that kills that many people the way and brutally as Gary Ridgeway did.
When you had 48 seconds of silence, was that something, was that your idea? And did that just kind of come up or had you planned on doing that?
Well, the women had all been identified or characterized as being involved in prostitution. And these were still young women who may have been misguided at that point in time in their life, but they weren't just throwaways that you could just say, we can justify what Gary did because they were undesirables in society because of what they did. And so most of my presentation to Gary Ridgeway was about the effect of what he did to other people. And I wanted to make sure I impressed upon him the effect of what he caused on other people. But at the same time, for the victim family members out there, I wanted to dignify them and have them recognize that this is somebody that hears my pain, that doesn't necessarily know what I'm feeling, but they at least heard my pain. I've shared with them everything I have to share with them. And to make sure that there was clarity, that I wanted to make sure that when they walked out that courtroom, justice was done as far as the sentencing that was imposed. Some wanted the death penalty, but that's not the way it went. But they felt that justice was done as far as the penalty and that the lives of their family members were dignified in some way. And I know 1 second hardly compares to the life of an individual, but at least it recognized their existence and their presence, and to make everybody think for those 48 seconds, these were important people whose lives they never got a chance to fully develop.
Yeah. How many cases, I mean, do you know how many you've done over the course of your career? Like, are there hundreds or are there 50?
We're way past that. Really? When I look at the 20 plus years, there's thousands of cases because there's everything from district court, which is a lower division, in state court, where you're handling scores of cases. You're trying case after case after case in King County. When they're in closing arguments, another case has already been assigned to you. So you're constantly in trial. Federal court, we don't try as many cases as often, but between the two, I've handled, tried, and been involved in, I can't imagine if somebody tried to count it up.
Okay. Yeah. And the reason I ask is because it's interesting if there's like multitasking skill sets you need to, you know, you have 10 cases at once or five or three, you know, a lot of different things going through your head. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, if you have five cases, I can't imagine handling five simultaneously. Going back in time, just, I mean, I asked this question to all my guests, but would you do anything different? Would you try to expedite the process to become a judge, or did it work out the way it was supposed to?
I think it worked out the way it was supposed to. And I have no reservations about how my life developed, because I think if I tried to become a judge, I certainly could have tried before. But I think when I went out to campaign for a King County Superior Court position, the first thing I talked about was readiness to try a case. There's not a day that I'm in court that I don't rely upon the skill set that I developed as a trial lawyer. There's a lot of anxiety on young lawyers to say, well, I want to be this. I want to be a judge. And they've only practiced a few years. Well, the only first time that you realize that you weren't ready is when you're on the bench and all of a sudden all that pressure's on you. And that beautiful ship that was at the shore that looked real good that you thought you were all that, all of a sudden now you're in a catastrophic set of circumstances that you're ill prepared to handle. I remember one judge, and I won't say their name or identify them, but I remember walking out the door at King County, and they were in an elective office. And I remember walking down the street, this is just a few months after they were as a judge, and they were sitting there in front of those barbecue place around from the courthouse, and he had his head in his hand. I said, are you okay? And he said, there's so many decisions I have to make. I didn't realize the rapidness of the speed of having to make the decisions and feel comfortable with the decisions. I feel like I'm just getting further and further behind because I can't make a decision. Difference is the experience level that you have as a trial lawyer that you fall upon to say, this is what helps me get to those indecisive times about what I'm supposed to do. I don't have a book to answer everything. I don't have a code that says this is a checkbox of what you do in these situations, but it's that experience component of your brain and your skill set that you have to rely upon to get you through pretty much everything you'll deal with on the bench.
What would you say the biggest surprise, like something you didn't see coming? Like, I know that you're very intelligent, you knew what you're getting yourself into, but maybe 15, 20 years into the career, was there something you're like, whoa, I didn't see this coming?
I'd say how fast it all goes by. I remember one of the senior judges, this is when I first became a federal judge, and he was up in years, he wasn't trying cases anymore. And we were talking, and he said, Richard, he said, one of the things you don't realize is how fast this goes. Enjoy every single day that you're on that bench, because one day, and it's not that far down the road, because it comes so quick, the lights go off, the newspaper headlines don't have your name in it, important decisions are made that don't involve you, and there's cases that are tried that you wish you could have tried. So every opportunity that you have to go in that courtroom, enjoy it, work hard for it, and give it everything that you have, because we're gifted with the opportunity to be judges.
So as we wind down, Richard, if you had, say, a child that's maybe come out of college, struggling, trying to figure out what they want to do, but they seem very interested in maybe following in your footsteps, is this a career? What would you say to them? Would you say to go for it, or would you caution them?
I'd say going with eyes wide open as opposed to eyes wide shut, because a lot of times eyes wide shut is, it's like watching the Super Bowl on Sunday. You look and think, God, I wish I was playing in the NFL. God, I wish I was playing football. Oh, I'd love to be the star. I'd love to be Travis Kelce. But guess what? During that game, he may have gotten hit 30, 40 times. He may have gotten a concussion, a broken bone, or like a player that didn't even get in the game because he injured himself right away. Know what it is that you have some idea that this is really something that you want to do. Don't be afraid to try. Don't be afraid to fail. You can't get an A if you're afraid to get an F. And most of the time people go in afraid that they're going to fail. They'll say, I'm not going to tell anybody. I want to go into law because people laugh or think that I can't do it. I don't have the skill set. Stay away from haters like that for starters, but go into it with the belief that this is something I want to do. The other thing is the courtroom's vast as far as the career opportunities. Now, sure, a judge may be at the top of the food chain in terms of the top position, but there's positions as lawyers. There's positions as court reporters. If you get a real good set of typing skills and listening skills, an investigator, people go out and investigate and print cases. If you're really smart in technology, somebody has to be able to present video capabilities in the courtroom. There's a whole variety of skill sets that you can still be connected and be involved in the courtroom. So don't be intimidated by saying, I would like to be involved in the law. I like the stuff that's on TV, but I don't want to be a lawyer and I don't want to be a judge. There's tons of other jobs connected to a courtroom.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because sometimes it might be the same industry, but different skill sets, right? Exactly. So maybe you won't be a judge. Maybe you'd be a great, you know, attorney, or who knows, the person typing it. I was going to ask you advice, but you kind of just gave the advice, so I won't ask that question again. I also assume that one thing I just popped in my brain is, like, things like we change, we evolve. Like, there's like cryptocurrency, for example. There's all these things that are changing. I would assume that you would have to be very on it, just to be aware of kind of new things that are going on in our world, because, you know, a case could come up in something that, you know, you have to do your homework. Like, are you always studying? Like, what's your, how do you, I mean, what do you read? What do you, and like when you're on a Sunday morning and you have a day off, are you like deep on your computer, like trying to figure out what's going on in the world?
Well, my strong advice is read, read, read more. I read about two or three different newspapers most days. I'm not going to advertise for any particular newspapers because I'll probably get in trouble. But read, read, read. You can't get enough by knowledge. Every time I've had a major challenge, I've gone out to get information to understand it. For example, I had gone to a course of study on DNA way before I got the Gary Ridgway case. It was just curiosity to find out. This is in the embryonic stage of the DNA in the courtroom. But I wanted to learn about this science, not knowing it would pay off years, years later. When I had the Gary Ridgway case and I knew the challenges that the media was going to present, first book I read was Handling Notorious Cases. And the second thing I did is I went to a course that was on for public information officers at the Judicial College. So it's getting knowledge and reading and learning about subject matters. We get so immersed in cases here, you have to expand your knowledge of what the subject matter is. You mentioned cryptocurrency, for example. That's brand new. AI is brand new. These are categories that there isn't legislation, there's no control, there's no law. And so it may be a case of first impression. I had the first DNA from an animal that was ever used anywhere in the country. I didn't have any place to go, but I had to go and read and know about DNA to understand the use of that technology in the courtroom as it applied to an animal's DNA.
So you read a lot. It's just curious. Do you have a favorite, like, fiction? Do you ever read fiction, or is it all nonfiction?
I read all over the place. Yeah. For example, there's a movie that's coming out now. It's on Netflix. It's called Shogun. I think it's a show. It's on Hulu, one of those stations. Okay. And I had read as a prosecutor, a King County prosecutor, 30, 40, whatever it is, years ago, about, I think it was James Clavell's series on the Shogun, Taipan, Taipan. Yep. I was fascinated by that. And I'm still fascinated by it today. So it's just having a curious mind to look at different things and want to learn about things. And I love to travel. And so the best passport you can ever have, and I'd encourage young people, if you can afford it, travel as much as you can, because somebody can tell you about the world, but until you're there and you've got boots on the ground, it won't really have a powerful meaning for you, and you'll never forget it.
I agree. Last question. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you think is important for the audience to hear or kind of leave them with?
No, I just say follow your passions. Particularly for young people, you have no idea where your career is going to take you, what opportunities are going to present to you. And so I know it's so enjoyable with Snapchat, Facebook, and all the rest of these social media communications. Those can be upturning for you for a career. When somebody comes to work for me, apply, we do a check on their social media just to see what that person's all about, the other side of that person. They'll tell us one thing in paper in an interview, but keep your record as clean as possible. Watch what you're communicating out on social media. Not that you live in fear, but just be mindful of what you send out there and what you do, because you don't know how it could impact your career. And I know if there's things that I had done that were recorded, that I was doing something weird or strange, it could be misinterpreted years ago before they had social media. Who knows? You just don't. So keep your nose clean, keep your nose straight, and keep going.
All right. I appreciate it very much. I thank you for coming on.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for asking me. And I encourage all your audience to continue to follow you, because Dirk, you're doing a fabulous job spreading the world, spreading your wealth and spreading your knowledge. You're a fantastic interviewer. Thank you so much.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.